Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, looking at the most progressive issues facing the entire planet, not just Americans. This far exceeds the political, ideological, and economic interest of just the left or the right. It impacts everyone, and that's global warming. My concern is that we are not paying the attention to this issue. We're either living in denial. About 50% of Americans say that either climate change does not exist, or if it does, it's not going to impact them. Even more, those who acknowledge global warming is real will then turn around and say, but our government is doing all it can. We passed the climate goals in the Parents Conference and other conferences, so we're all right. We have time. Joining me in studio in New York City, Richard Gale, our executive producer. We have been on top of this for more than 10 years. We've been doing an ongoing report on the state of our planet, not just global warming, on the acidification of our oceans, the bleaching of the coral reefs, the high heat temperatures, the garbage patch, the dead zones in the oceans, the melting of the glaciers, the melting of Antarctica and the Arctic Circle, as well as Greenland. We're also looking at coal mining and gas hydrofracking, oil production onshore and offshore, and nuclear power and their dangers and how they actually contribute to the degradation of life on Earth. Just look at Fukushima. Not a word about it anywhere in the media, and yet it's continuing to spill 300,000 gallons of toxic radioactive material into the ocean, as well as polluting their own aquifer system and polluting the crops in the air in Japan. So all the different tipping points we have discussed in depth. We have invited some of the world's leading climatologists and environmentalists on this program to share their points of view, some more conservative in their view, others almost frighteningly honest in that they tell us we do not have the time. I tend to look at all this as an environmentalist, as a conservationist, as a scientist. And right now, I'm of the belief, based upon what I see occurring, that we do not have a lot of time before the events become so catastrophic that we cannot reverse them no matter what we do. Now, that does not mean that the world comes to an end. It doesn't mean that societies collapse. It doesn't mean that lots of people die. What it means is that we will then end up with a nation where certain crops cannot be grown, where we will be too hot. The soil's too hot, especially in our breadbasket. If you go out to Iowa and Illinois, Kansas, and South Dakota, North Dakota, and Colorado, places that historically have been our breadbasket, won't be in the future. We're losing the largest aquifer in America, the Agalaga water system. It's over 50% depleted. And the heat in the soil. You see, here's the tricky part. A lot of this is in ways that are almost imperceptible. If you go out in the summertime and one day it's 85, and then the next day it's 90, it's not a big deal. You can adapt to it. But the soil can't, and seeds can't. And therefore, things that have to have a lower temperature simply won't germinate or won't grow to fruition if they do. Then you have the rains, monumental rains, that so saturate the soil that it drowns out and rots out the root system of crops. But again, as long as you go to the store and instead of getting an apple or a cherry from Michigan or Washington State, you can get one from South Africa. There's always some place growing what we're not because of the we're in the winter, they're in the summer in Argentina and South Africa. So we live in this bubble. We live in a vacuous bubble where we are intentionally deprived of the truth. The air we're breathing is highly propagandized and politicized. There are groups of individuals like the Koch brothers who have the power to control not only the legislative process, but much of the media and the talking points. We have a good number of very skilled and highly qualified journalists who refuse to kowtow to the corporate line, and they're excluded. You'll never see them in any of these network or cable shows telling us the truth. So the people who are considered the experts by the establishment, these are modifiers, pacifiers. These are people who want to blanderdize, standardize everything, emulsify the truth down to where it seems completely innocuous. But it's not. In fact, I'm going to share some thoughts with you today that will allow us, along with Richard Gale, an opportunity to see the truth. And here's why this program is so important. The vast majority of Americans will get their information from the mainstream or cable systems. Even the internet has a lot of the same voices speaking on its behalf. There are trolls, there are groups set up that are there to attack the integrity and the reputation of people who speak out. For example, we just found out that the makers of Vioxx, Merck, had set up a team of people to discredit doctors or other experts who would testify against the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory Vioxx that killed at least 60,000 Americans. Who knew there were secret character assassination teams? On top of that, we have Wikipedia. In my personal opinion, Wikipedia is a gulag. They can attack people without fear. They can do so in a mocking way. They're anonymous, as if we're supposed to believe in this day of highly contentious debate and argument that there is no group of individuals astroturfing, working on behalf of special interests, whether it's the CIA, which is a matter of fact, or major corporations like the pharmaceutical companies or the big agri companies that are not infiltrating every social platform. They start arguments. They're agent provocateurs. You wouldn't know that. You just see that someone was slandered or libeled. You don't know the truth. In fact, on our program earlier, I wrote and submitted a letter to Michael Moore, my second in the last 2 years. My first was to encourage him to vote for Jill Stein and come to a more progressive platform instead of supporting, not just supporting, but almost obsessive in his over-support for Hillary Clinton. And I brought up some of the things that if you're going to support this person completely, not just because you want a Democrat or a so-called liberal, but you want a woman, then I could give you the names of 200 highly qualified women who would make wonderful presidents for all the people who are not there to lie and to deceive and to manipulate, as the Clintons have. But my letter was unanswered. My hope is that this one will be. And I laid out some good arguments. At least I consider them good. And the letter's there for everyone to read. It's open. And it was not an attack letter. Rather, it was a letter to say, hey, isn't it time that you look beyond just attacking Trump to supporting progressive causes? Because at the end of the day, it almost looks like when the great meteor hit and suddenly the earth was covered in darkness, large part of it, and 95% of the dinosaurs went extinct. That was a primary cause. And where a volcano had erupted, and the dinosaurs are so intent on fighting each other, they don't pay attention to the lava flow approaching. Well, the lava flow is approaching. And it's time that we stop this fighting and at least look for positive solutions to our crisis. Richard Gale joins us now. Hi, Richard.
Gary.
Richard, let's first go through your research, because we are giving more than opinions. We're giving, based upon good scholarship, how did we get to this place where neither the Democrat Party, nor the Republican Party, nor the mainstream media, nor most journalists are doing anything constructive? I'm not talking about euphemisms and happy speech and we're going to deal with this and these conferences around the world. I'm talking about actual doing something. And that leaves the American people to do nothing. They might buy a flaxseed bag or hemp bag and stop using a plastic bag, but in the end, that's not going to change any of the tipping points. We need a Marshall Plan. We need a worldwide unified effort right now, including the biggest polluters, the biggest adulterators of the environment and animal life, China, India, the United States, to join together, because we're the ones who pollute the most, use the most resources, and are doing the least to confront this. So give us your take on how do we get to the mess that we're in. And then also, I want to add in that a friend for a long time, and in my opinion, one of the brighter people within the liberal community, is Steve Brown. And I had mentioned today, because Steve sent me a missive last night about why he, on domestic issues, he felt that Hillary Clinton would be a better president. And it wasn't as if it was the lesser of two evils. He said that it would be, you know, the worst and then even worse than the worst. And so on Clinton's domestic policies, he may be right. And I'm sure that Michael Moore would probably share his points of view. I want to read what he has to say because we want to deal with this in greater depth. And I've done some homework today to answer Steve on both issues, but also, more importantly, is to address Michael Moore's unbridled, unconditional support of everything Hillary and corporate Democrat. And it's really corporate Democrat. And here is what Steve had to say. Quote, what I said simply was that in retrospect, and with regard to the specific points I enumerated, e.g. Hillary would not have appointed an army of judges to the federal bench that of the caliber that Trump did, overturned nearly 100 environmental protections and OSHA regulations, made it okay to be publicly racist and cruel, or handed a $1 trillion tax cut to the billionaire class without throwing a public relations sop, however small, to the bottom 99%. The election of Hillary would have benefited the world more than the election of Trump. This is not a debatable proposition. Sorry, Steve, I respect that point of view, but I would hold a different point of view, and I'll share my point of view. And also, Steve's views about Hillary are only valid on the domestic front. He does not, and I want to make this very clear, Steve Brown does not support what Hillary's foreign policy decisions were because, as he said, quote, Hillary's foreign policy decisions would have been pretty close to what they have been under Trump, not because Hillary shares Trump's policy ideas. Trump has no policy ideas, only whims, but because the views of those who set our national agenda, those who actually run the government while Trump tweets, share the same policy goals as Hillary. Trump's coterie of advisors may be cruder and crueler than Hillary's, but they march to the same drummer. Although Trump may speak admirably and admiringly and behave fawningly towards Putin in public, those who pull the levers of our government in his name behind the scenes nevertheless continue to tighten the screws of economic sanctions on Russia and continue to stoke Russia's well-justified fears of an invasion by the West each time NATO stages another of its provocative military exercises on Russia's border. We are therefore no further from a world-ending nuclear confrontation with Russia under Trump than we would have been under Hillary. Okay. And I accept that, and on that I agree. But take us now through what got us to this point and why neither the left nor the right are doing anything of meaning to slow down, stop, or wherever possible, reverse, and most importantly, to actually honestly warn people who are living in environmentally non-sustainable locations. While there's still time, we should move you. We should help you move. We should help you relocate. And why none of that is being done, not in California, not in Florida, not in Texas, not in Louisiana, Mississippi, the very places that have been devastated in the last 12 months by environmental disasters. The forum is yours.
Okay, Gary. I think the transition, the real turning point, was Reagan's administration. Reagan turned his back on a wonderful, wonderful legacy of the Republicans had on conservation and the environment. I mean, they were, up until Reagan, the Republicans were recognized as the party of conservation and the environment, going back to Theodore Roosevelt. And as I'll mention, I think Richard Nixon was probably, perhaps, really the most important environmentalist and actually had an equal understanding of climate change as Jimmy Carter did. And he had, of course, the economy was much better during Nixon than what Jimmy had inherited. So there were a lot of wonderful efforts that Nixon made. But this transition, and the Democrats in response to Reagan, it was always they were always kind of in the backdrop of Reagan, and that's certainly true of Clinton. When Clinton and Gore had to redefine the Democrat Party, almost by mirroring a lot of Reagan's policies as being a friend of Wall Street, so it was a reactive platform that they have, but it was really, I think, at the point of Reagan when both Republicans and Democrats turned their back on climate change and environmental issues in favor of economic growth and stimulus, trade, and just kind of coming to the close of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union thereafter, just the expansion of American hegemony through corporate interests, and that would of course bring wealth back into the country. But I would like to mention just. Turn to Nixon for his example, because he was the one to sign the National Environmental Policy Act. You know, all new building projects required an environmental impact report for any kind of a major, large project. His ranking aide was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a highly recognized environmentalist. There's a memo that Moynihan had written to Nixon where he warned about the consequences of climate change and how the Earth would be getting warmer, sea levels would rise. Even in the memo, he was mentioning goodbye New York, goodbye Washington. And Nixon had a full understanding of the threats of CO2, carbon dioxide. He actually wrote, and this is what Reagan wrote, that this rise, we should seize the imagination of persons normally indifferent to projects of apocalyptic change. And he completely blamed the rise of the CO2 rise on human activity, mostly the burning of fossil fuels. He was the one that created the Environmental Protection Agency. He later founded the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which now Trump has he's removed even there. CO2 monitoring system is under the NOAA. That program no longer exists. Okay, Trump has already cut that, and he expanded on. He approved the Clean Water Act, the Pesticide Control Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act. He revised and strengthened the Endangered Species Act that Johnson started, and Johnson also he was aware. He had a scientific advisory committee to actually do predictions of what climate change, the effects it might have. And in that report, this is like 1965, were references to the Antarctic. Ice cap melting, the rising sea levels, increasing ocean acidity. These were all in that report. And again, the report had concluded that the rise of CO2 and climate change would have deleterious effects from the point of view of human beings. So I think there was a much greater awareness of what happened during this period of time when there was kind of an awareness, and then with Jimmy Carter, and then it just ended. It just completely ended. And when we really go back and we look at, we don't have to speak too much on Reagan on this, because Reagan oscillated between being just indifferent towards climate change and just direct hostility to it. And you might remember he had hired, James Watt as the Secretary of Interior, who just favored capitalist growth by any means over environmental protections or ecological preservation. And he had hired Helen Bruford to just basically gut the EPA. But when we go to Bill Clinton, and here, it's kind of funny. As governor of Arkansas, the environmental record of Arkansas was pretty dismal. It was rated poor to fair, which is perhaps the only reason why he really needed Gore as a running mate. He throughout his time as the governor, he consistently courted and subsidized the poultry industry, which is a world-class polluter of rivers and streams. We know that. There was an interesting article written by Tech Magazine, which is out of MIT, after Clinton won his second term. And it was a very detailed, sharp criticism of Clinton's environmental record. And Gore basically didn't do anything. He just really kind of emerges as a climate change crusader and champion in 2000, and with his film and that book he had written. That's when he became kind of the poster boy for climate change. But overall, Clinton really didn't accomplish very much. Clinton did attend the big Rio Climate Conference in '92. He's advocated many different policies, but he never really enacted on anything. You know, they spearheaded Kyoto, the Kyoto Treaty Protocol, but he never submitted it to Congress for approval. All the other countries, you know, were ready to ratify it, but now that's completely off the table now. In fact, it was actually George Bush that eventually signed the Kyoto Treaty. So there's not much we can really say in favor of anything that Clinton really did to protect the environment. It was usually more a battle he had with Republicans in Congress just to stop from what they wanted to do with deregulation or ripping apart consumer bills and acts protecting citizens. He spent most of his two terms was really just fighting the Republicans on attacking the regulations rather than adding anything or helping move along the cause of conservative action towards climate change. And then when we jump into Hillary, Hillary pretty much just mimics Obama. The Clean Power Plan, which was one of the first things that Trump has written off now. That would have regulated carbon emissions. In fact, that's the only planned policy that could have allowed us to meet the Paris Accord agreements on climate change, which, you know, we really have not completely signed on to either. But it was Clinton. It was Hillary Clinton who initiated what was called the Global Shale Initiative through the State Department. And this was her attempt to be able to promote the American gas fracking firms into poorer countries and poorer nations to just extract gas movements. And, you know, at the end of Obama, and Obama was very, very proud of this, he considered this one of his greatest accomplishments, is that the U.S. became the world's largest oil and natural gas producer. It was a sign, and he was cheerful of that, you know, we had moved towards a kind of a point of independence from fossil fuels, although that we know we're still forced to import a lot of our oil and fossil fuels for our energy needs still. One of the big things. Oh, and then the Clinton Foundation, which receives money from big oil like ExxonMobil, the Saudis, ConocoPhillips. They've basically bought the influence of the Clintons. There's the big Canadian oil mogul, Frank Gustira from the Canadian public oil company Pacific Rubiales, who's been accused of multiple human rights violations in Colombia, but he sits on the Clinton Foundation's board. She supported offshore drilling. She sided with Republicans in 2006 to open up new Gulf Coast areas. So, again, where we see this change really happening is with Reagan. And I think it's just those years happen to have been the lead up to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then a unipolar world that is ruled and controlled by the U.S. only, and allowing for real true imperial ambitions through the corporate structure to then mobilize. There, we were no longer in a bipolar world of two military powers. It was just one power with both a military and a thriving economy, which the former Soviet Union certainly didn't have. And I think this is where the whole shift in consciousness and awareness, the memes were definitely set into both the Republicans and the Democrats to just take climate change, take the environment, and just, you know, either, you know, remove it from the table altogether, as Trump has done, or to just fall back into the hubris of, you know, human ignorance, thinking that we have the ingenuity and the wherewithal to fix all the problems we create through our own technological know-how and charm. And so that's where I kind of see that we're at in this situation right now.
Thank you for that overview. I'd like to add a few of the very important headlines today. This is from Global Research, Dr. Andrew Glickson. Hothouse Earth, Demise of the Planetary Life Support System. In a key paper entitled Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene, published in the Proceedings of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, a group of 17 climate environmental scientists, some of the tops, are saying that they have warned that a stern warning to humanity with regard to the future of the planet. I'll just quote this paragraph. I thought it was interesting because I saw this nowhere in the mainstream media, none. Quote, "We explore the risk that self-reinforcing feedback loops could push the Earth system towards a planetary threshold that, if crossed, could prevent stabilization of the climate at intermediate temperature rises and cause continued warming on a hothouse Earth pathway even as human emissions are reduced. Crossing the threshold would lead to a much higher global average temperature than any interglacial in the past 1.2 million years and the sea levels significantly higher than at any time in the Holocene. We examined the evidence that such a threshold might exist and where it might be. And if the threshold is crossed, the resulting trajectory would likely cause serious disruptions to ecosystems, society, and economies. Collective human action is required to steer the Earth system away from the potential threshold and stabilize it in a habitable interglacial state-like state." So that's one. Then here's another one. And this is from the Tomsk Polytech University. "Massive emissions of methane in the Arctic become a significant source of greenhouse gases. Quote, the rate of vertical degradation and subsea permafrost in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf is 18 centimeters a year over the past 30 years, which is greater than previously thought. Scientists from Tomsk Polytech University received this data after the comprehensive study of subsea permafrost not only in the Russian Arctic, but also in the Arctic as a whole." And then it goes on to talk about that historically, everyone believed that it's going to take longer for this massive ice floor of a very shallow Arctic and very shallow, very, very shallow, sometimes only 100 feet deep off Siberia, for that to thaw. And now their newest study showing we were wrong. It's thawing very fast, and so fast that it's possible to have a gigantic methane burp. And to give an idea, they estimate that there could easily be a 5-gigaton methane burp. And if there was a 5-gigaton methane burp, that could overnight, I mean, like real fast, it could change and take us above the 2 degrees Celsius level, which would radically and forever change global warming. It would get so hot in so many areas that there'd be reinforcing feedback loops where the water was so hot, ice couldn't quickly and thickly impact in the wintertime. As a result, it'd be thin to non-existent. So they're saying that this is happening as we speak, that all of scientists missed it, that everyone was wrong. And this is important that we realize that the so-called best and brightest have missed it. They were just damn wrong. Everyone was wrong in the mainstream scientific community of thinking we have time. And as the Buddha says, you don't have time. And every scientific report I get, no one has time, except those filled with hubris and those in the corporate liberal and the corporate conservative communities and those average Americans who don't give a damn about anything or anyone ever. And that's a whole lot of people who simply are intentionally living with intentional neglect, not only of the simple things of life, but of the complex systems as well. They refuse to acknowledge complex systems, that they're a part of them. And here's something that just people won't wrap their mind around, Richard. I'd like your response on this. If a parent intentionally gives their children sugared foods and junk foods, and they see the child grow to obesity and have arthritis and heart disease, and see that they're diabetic, why would we assume that these millions of parents are somehow going to be very conscientious about not buying GMO foods, about not buying things they don't need, about being concerned about the global temperatures or the fate of animals, or the or reducing the poverty in our inner cities or urban areas? Where are they suddenly supposed to be completely unconscious in their life on when it comes to their own personal health, their children's health, and very conscious to a meaningful level when it comes to anything else? I just think we are in such denial of how far we've flown down that rabbit hole. We're not walking, we're flying down it into stupidity and intentional hubris and intentional indifference to we just don't give a damn. Well, if enough people don't give a damn, if enough people are so selfish, then I don't see where anything is going to turn around. And I'm not negative, because for those of us who are smart enough or care enough or sensitive enough or spiritual enough to want to know, even if it takes time and effort to do so, then we could make some effort with our own personal health and with our own personal happiness and even where the best places to live. And my final thought is this. There's a film on television that's worth watching for no other reason to see how depraved people are, how selfish people are, how narcissistic people are, how superficial people are. And it's called Below Deck, and it's about a luxury yacht, not necessarily a large one. But on this luxury yacht, you see people renting it out for a weekend or a day, and you see the crew, in my opinion, not nice people, and you see the guests, horrible people. Now, the guests are generally either professional class, meaning the careerists who have money and want to show they can spend that kind of money, because these cruises are expensive, or the millionaire class. And without exception, their family members are spoiled, rotten brats, the kind of people that when you see how petulant, how self-centered, how superficial they are, you think, wow, that's the future? Yeah, chum, that's the future. So if we've got 17.2 million of the professional class with their families, that brings you up to 68 million. And with 10 million of the millionaire class with their families, that brings you up to over 40 million. Then you're dealing with about 112 million of the most selfish, self-centered, disconnected from reality, intellectually stupefied individuals. They live in a bubble of selective knowledge, and everything else in the world they don't care about. They don't care about people, animals, nothing. The whole world revolves around how do I feel and what else can I do to show people I have some value. So you've got one third of the entire American population, and in that one third are all the policymakers and opinion leaders. And these are the people that support political campaigns. These are the people in corporations. These are the people who are the and these are not even the uber rich. So if we exclude them from the solution, Then we exclude the one half of all the population that will never do anything for anyone in their life except if there's an emergency, but they're not going to change their lifestyle. They're not going to change, stop eating hamburgers or buying plastic crap or buying stuff they don't need. They're not going to stop. So we got half who don't care about anything, the other half who are certain in their they're not caring about people, but they're rich enough not to feel that they owe anyone an explanation for their selfishness. Now you're dealing with about 5% of the American population who really care, who will do things, who will buy organic and support local union-made or American-made, who support a living wage, who support deghettoization. These are the real progressives. So you got 95% of the people in America who are not going to do a damn thing. They haven't historically. They're not going to now. And then we got 5% of the people who are going to do something. How in the world do you change what's happening to the environment at every level when you have a 95-5 option?
You know, I think our civilization is thoroughly Freudian. It's it's a trek from chronic neurosis to normal unhappiness that, to me, seems to best characterize. In that sense, it's very much like Freud. It's that I think very much characterizes so much of our society. And the other thing is I wanted to bring up, because Guy McPherson brought this up on our program once, and there was another interesting article a couple months ago on one of the climate news sites, I think Climate Nexus, that many of these scientists, climate scientists, who are looking at data and traveling and going to the Arctic or Greenland or up to glaciers or into Antarctica to do monitoring. And a lot of this is these are grueling trips. This is not a luxury liner or a vacation. They undergo some very deep depression. There's something about when you actually are looking at the data, you're staring at the data, and looking at the effects from year after year or however many years they go back in their area of specialty. If they're going into the Siberian tundra, the Arctic Circle, and you go back a couple years later and you see how worse things are than it was earlier, the previous time. And they have it's an experience. You know, there's something, and that brings about a wisdom. Wisdom doesn't come from just book learning. It comes from having these deep experiences that we specialize in. So we have both the know-how and the data, but we have that experience that kind of confirms the knowledge, confirms just the knowledge and the book knowledge or the data. And they go through these very deep depressions. And like Guy McPherson is getting involved with this, helping them, some of these scientists, to go through a grieving process, almost like a death process, in order to become more proactive. Because when we can, we are a culture in complete denial of death, and like Ernst Becker, the great philosopher, sociologist, wrote, you know, the book "The Escape from Death," and to define our culture, we'll just go to McDonald's. We'll spend more hours in front of the TV or mobile phones or whatever it is. All these kind of mental games that we play are just ways to escape that death. And I think we do. I think we something many of us we need to face in order to kind of come to the other side of that and to become more compassionate and loving and really to see the truth before us.
But we don't have that at this moment because, as a nation, we lack a spiritual awareness and an essential understanding of the meaning of our own life. We do not have any depth of spiritual understanding. And not that we couldn't, we could, but we choose not to. You see, people never ask this question. What do you gain by being dysfunctional, greedy, selfish, self-centered? What do you gain from it? And we'd like to think nothing. That's not true. People actually gain from the crisis they're in. And only once you understand what does a person gain from what the crisis they put themselves into or find themselves in, can you find a way of reversing that? But we're not even able to have that dialogue because no one wants to hear it. It's not a little tiny soundbite. You know, when someone told me once, you got to keep all of your videos very short. And then my agent, who I fired, said, you know, you got to write very short books for the younger people because, quite frankly, they're not going to read longer ones. And I said, then I've published over 100 books. I've had over 70 bestsellers. I've sold, according to the best resources, over 47 million copies. The day that I have to acquiesce to a dumbed-down public to write a book is the last day that I will write a book. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do it. We have to have people in our society who are willing to stand up for something other than their egos and something other than a paycheck and actually raise the bar on some values that people should adhere to. And if we don't, then look at the snowflakes, look at the selfish people, look at the different identity politics movements, look at how destructive these are. And so I just extend this to looking at the world we live in. Now, right now, Jakarta, according to this report from the official BBC news site, quote, Jakarta, the fastest sinking city in the world, quote, the Indonesian capital of Jakarta is home to 10 million people, but it's also one of the fastest sinking cities in the world. If it goes unchecked, parts of the megacity could be entirely submerged in the near future. And it sits on a swampy land, the Java Sea lapping against it, and 13 rivers running through it. So it shouldn't be surprised that flooding is frequent in Jakarta. But what's being done about it? Nothing. Now, what's being done about the Keys? Nothing. And Miami? Nothing. Except every hustler and every person who can sell anyone to anything is going to do so without ever mentioning, friend, you're buying an apartment, you're buying a condo where you're not going to be able to live it in 5 to 10 years or sooner. No one's being honest. Jerry Brown, no one's being honest. No one's capable of being honest because there's a consequence to honesty. You mentioned Guy McPherson. You realize what happened to his career and reputation once he told the truth that we have about 13 years maximum before we start seeing really devastating effects. And now he's not invited almost any place to talk. And now what about the other 15 individuals who have good reputations also who are now coming forward saying, Guy McPherson was right, but he wasn't right enough. It's worse than what he said.
Yes. Yeah.
All right? Now we have about 15 people, no longer one, 15. And by next year, we'll have 100 coming forward. Will it take, you know, a certain number before we finally wake up? And I want to do this with some of the time we have here. I want to mention why this is exactly the time that we should be bringing Ralph Nader and his legacy back in to the equation, having him talk. You know, he's not an archaic symbol of the past. He is vital today. He's highly intelligent, one of the most brilliant people you ever hear, because he supports environmental changes, and he's got a record. We went back to Grist Staff 2008 and saw all the things he was telling then, quote, calls for phasing out of all fossil fuels within 20 years, oil and coal first, and natural gas, supporting solar, wind, tidal, and other renewable powers, and he wants to get rid of all nuclear quickly. He wants to get rid of the coal mining and chopping up all the hills in Tennessee and Kentucky and West Virginia and Pennsylvania from that coal mining. And you think, well, Bob, yeah, he's right. But no one paid attention to him. So what we did is this, and this is for Michael Moore, a letter I wrote to him today. Here's what Obama and Clinton, and I'm including their domestic policies, for those of you who believe, and some of you I'm sure do, that we'd have been much better off with Hillary Clinton on the domestic front. Listen carefully what they actually supported, and then compare that to Ralph Nader. Repeal the worst labor law, the Taft-Hartley Act, which intrudes on freedom of speech. Obama and Clinton, no, don't repeal it. Ralph Nader, yes. Halt nuclear energy. Obama and Clinton actually increased nuclear energy, increased nuclear arms by $1 trillion. Ralph Nader, end it all. Reduce hydrofracking. Clinton, Obama, not at all. Expand it. Nader, get rid of it. Continue fossil fuel subsidies by billions of dollars. Oh, yeah, Obama and Clinton suggest give the big companies lots of money. Ralph Nader, not a penny. Clean coal, Clinton, Obama, yes. Nader, there is no such thing. Offshore drilling, no. Federal protection of public lands, yes to Nader, and not so much for Clinton and them. And then overhaul the EPA, yes. And them, no. And a tax on speculative trading, no to Clinton, Obama, yes on Nader. Labeling of GMOs and repeal the DARK Act, no for Clinton and Obama, yes for Ralph Nader. Also, the national minimum wage should be $15 and or higher immediately, no, just incrementally on Clinton and Obama, yes on Ralph Nader. Repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, no. That's the most important single act that destroyed American economy and caused the Great Recession. The repeal the Glass-Steagall Act by Hillary Clinton, because remember, if no one knows this, the front face of a president was the warm and charming and effusively upbeat Bill Clinton. The actual president of the United States was Hillary Clinton. Just speak with any of the people who work for her, and you'll hear this, including a 25-year close friend and a person that worked for them has said this on the record repeatedly. So they supported the Glass-Steagall, and that's what caused the recession. To reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act? No. Yes on Nader. Reinstate it. Repeal Citizens United? Again. And support of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? No. But yes for Nader. Yes, get rid of these treaties. And reform NAFTA and CAFTA? No to Clinton and Obama. And yes for Nader. Forgive student loans? No. And then Nader, yes. Repeal the National Defense Authorization Act. Well, it was Obama who signed it in law and Clinton supported it? No. But Ralph Nader, yes. This is where they can arrest you without charge, keep you indefinitely, kill you if they choose to, with no recourse to you. You'll never know who was testifying against you. You'll never know the evidence against you. You can be kept in solitary confinement. You could be tortured. Obama supports that. Hillary Clinton supports that. That's a domestic policy, friends. How would you like your ass arrested in the middle of the night by Obama or Clinton surrogates, taken to a prison, waterboarded or tortured, and you have no opportunity not to make one phone call? You'll stay there unless they want to come and put you in front of a firing squad. That's the National Defense Authorization Act. That's why, instead of supporting Chris Hedges and the courage this man had to sue the Obama administration to repeal that, instead people mocked and ridiculed him. So, get rid of the Patriot Act? No, for Clinton. That's a domestic policy, the Patriot Act. And that means anything you say or write using your freedom of speech can be used against you to make you into a domestic terrorist. Ralph Nader, yes. And also, forgive student debt. I mentioned that. And protect whistleblowers, Obama and Clinton? No. Nader, yes. Legalize drugs and marijuana, Obama and Clinton? No. And Nader, yes. Universal health care, no. And Nader, yes. Break up the big banks, no. Clinton, Obama, yes on Nader. And also repeal the Patriot Act, no. And Nader, yes, repeal it, get rid of it. Support Saudi Arabia, Clinton, Obama, yes, support Saudi Arabia, who just beheaded 2 days ago, a woman who they've held with her husband for 3 years, a Shia, who was simply peacefully protesting a lack of democracy in Saudi Arabia. Where are the women? Where are the people standing up and crying out that this so-called reformer, this Wahhabist, is beheading women? And by the way, to tell you how dumb our press is, now they are beyond culpable in this. He said he came here and did this multi-publicity tour, all the while saying he's a reformer, he's a reformer. Do you know that he arrested all of the activist women in Saudi Arabia? They're still in prison, all of them, so that there'll be no one protesting anymore about not being able to drive without the a male relative in the car with you. So there's no longer, in Saudi Arabia, as I'm speaking, there's no longer any more female activists at all. They've all been arrested. Did anyone complain? Did you hear about it by the female reporters for the New York Times or Washington Post, or are they not able to get the information that we, Richard, you and I, and Chris Hedges and Cornel West and other progressives can get? Isn't it amazing the firewall between truth and propaganda? And there's Ralph Nader saying, no, don't do business with Saudi Arabia. Oppose Israel, apartheid, to Palestine. No to Obama. And yes, Ralph Nader said, yes, oppose it. And decrease our nuclear arsenal. A no to Obama and Clinton. And yes to Ralph Nader. And cease aggressive threats towards China. No. And Ralph Nader, yes, stop it. And stop NATO containment of Russia. No to Clinton, Obama. And yes to Nader. Now, that's only half of what we have. Get rid of all money and campaigning. No to Clinton and Obama. Yes to Nader. Overhaul pharmaceutical pricing. No, Clinton, Obama. Yes to Nader. Mandate vaccines. Yes, they want to mandate vaccines, Clinton and Obama. No, Ralph Nader wants freedom of choice. Reduce militarization of law enforcement. No, Clinton, Obama. Yes, Nader. Expand Social Security. No, Obama and Clinton. Yes, Nader. Overhaul the National Security Agency surveillance. No, Obama and Clinton. Yes, Nader. Reform public airwaves. No, Clinton, Obama. Yes, Nader. Free public college education. Unlikely under Obama and Clinton. Yes, under Nader. Reduce support for charter schools. Privatization of our educational system. No, to Clinton, Obama. Yes, under Nader. Reform our judicial system, which is utterly corrupt and biased. No, Obama and Clinton. Yes, under Nader. And increase public funds for public housing. No, under Obama and Clinton. Yes, under Nader. And strengthen hate crime laws. Yes, on both. And so there you have it. Now, when you realize how much the Democrats and the liberal community have hated Ralph Nader, demonized him, he is quite simply the best human being ever that has influenced public life that I know of in this country. No president, no legislator, no journalist has done as much. And he should be one of the wise people sitting at a table helping direct our future and giving the younger people, the younger millennials, the truth in depth with real scholarship about what progressive ideals, including on the climate, should be instead of what we have now, which is just twiddly-dee, twiddly-do. Walk away, everyone, from the corporate Democrat and the corporate Republican parties and join the people like Ralph Nader and a future that at least we can have some control over. Final thoughts, Richard.
Well, where do I begin, Gary? there's
a quote that kind of comes to my mind. I'm going to have to paraphrase it because I don't know it exact, but from Frederick Douglass back in the 19th century. And I think he kind of describes the situation very well that we find ourselves today. And it has something to do, like, in order to make a contented slave, okay, it was first necessary to make a thoughtless one. You know, you have to darken the moral and the mental vision as far as possible and basically annihilate the power of reason. And I think that pretty well defines where we're at in terms of our culture, the American, modern American culture today. I am inspired by a lot of the younger generation. Many of them come up to where I live up in the Berkshires. They come up to out of Brooklyn and Queens to work on the farm. They're very hip. They're very cool. There's a whole group of them that are trying to start just a clinic up there. They don't know that. There is a young doctor. He's 30 years old. We're emergency room doctor in Queens, who's long hair. He's leaving. He's just going to start a little clinic in this rural area, but to offer all kinds of different alternative care, too. So I find that very, very inspiring. But it's not going to be enough to take on the power and the influence and the wealth behind the entire machine that's driving this culture into this kind of forgetfulness, this darkening of our morals and visions that Frederick Douglass is speaking about. But as long as there are these pockets of people doing this, and I like Cornel West's image, that what we need today are love warriors.
You know, I agree. Richard, we're out of time. Thanks a lot for being on, Richard Gale. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality.